my dream will come true. On my last breath, oh master, I'll call out to you.
Oh light of my love, you are my true guide. I'm waiting for you to die by your side.
As I said, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells the Prophet, tell the people, I do not ask for any wage for my mission except friendship and kindness toward my family and household. And we said that some, unfortunately, did not give them enough love and affection towards the household of the Prophet, starting from his daughter at his, right after his demise, and then moved to his grandson and his family. Anyhow, this was a duty that was actually legislated by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for us as Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
In another hadith, the Holy Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "La yu'min 'abdun hatta akuna ahabba ilayhi min nafsihi wa takuna 'itrati ilayhi azza min 'itratihi." No person, no believer brings the real iman and belief except my own family.
Mm-hmm.
Except me is more important than him, or except my family is more important than his own family.
True.
So what does it mean? So we are waiting for this for the let's say grandson of the same family. So yeah, we have been told, even it is Quranic order to love Imam alayhi salam.
True.
Because he is among the household of the Prophet, isn't he? He's from the Ahlul Bayt. Yeah. Imam Mahdi is the grandson of the Holy Prophet from the same dynasty and generation. And then this is our duty to love him and strengthen this love. And definitely loving him will uplift us in excellence,
because,
and inshallah, and
because
goodness.
We said that loving someone who is like highly, highly spiritual will always uplift you. And performing this duty is not just a duty. It's actually working on Quran and paying back Prophet Muhammad, as he rightly said, that if you want to pay me back for my deeds, whatever I did for you, just allow me and my family. And Imam Ajallahu Ta'ala Faraja is among his family. Thank you so much, Dr. Alevi, for
You're
being
welcome.
With us. Thank you, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. The number of competitive congressional districts is on track to dive near and possibly below the lowest level in at least three decades, as Republicans and Democrats draw new political maps designed to ensure that the vast majority of House races are over before the general election starts. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Reed Epstein and Nick Corazzaniti. The piece is titled, "Taking the Voters Out of the Equation: How the Parties Are Killing Competition." In the United States, the number of competitive congressional districts is on track to dive near and possibly below the lowest level in at least three decades, as Republicans and Democrats draw new political maps designed to ensure that the vast majority of House races are over before the general election starts. With two-thirds of the new boundaries set, mapmakers are on pace to draw fewer than 40 seats out of 435 that are considered competitive based on the 2020 presidential election results, according to a New York Times analysis of election data. 10 years ago, that number was 73. While the exact size of the battlefield is still emerging, the sharp decline for competition for House seats is the latest worrying sign of dysfunction in the American political system, which is already struggling with a scourge of misinformation and rising distrust in elections. Lack of competition in general elections can widen the ideological gulf between the two political parties, leading to hardened state stalemates on legislation and voters' alienation from the political process. The reduction of competitive seats is a tragedy, said former Attorney General Eric Holder, who is the chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. Eric Holder added, "We end up with gridlock, we end up with no progress, and we end up with a population looking at our legislatures and having this feeling that nothing gets done." He added, "This gridlock leads to cynicism about the whole political process." Both Republicans and Democrats are responsible for adding to the tally of safe seats. Over decades, the parties have deftly used the redistricting process to create districts dominated by voters from one party or to bolster incumbents. It's not yet clear which party will ultimately benefit more from this year's bumper crop of safe seats, or whether President Joe Biden's sagging approval ratings might endanger Democrats whose districts haven't been considered competitive. Republicans control the map-making for more than twice as many districts as Democrats, leaving many in the GOP to believe that the party can take back the House majority after 4 years of Democratic control, largely by drawing favorable seats. But Democrats have used their power to gerrymander more aggressively than expected. In New York, for example, the Democratic-controlled legislature on Wednesday approved a map that gives the party a strong chance of flipping as many as 3 House seats currently held by Republicans. That has left Republicans and Democrats essentially at a draw, with 2 big outstanding unknowns. Florida's 28 seats, increasingly the subject of Republican infighting, are still unsettled, and several court cases in other states could send lawmakers back to the drawing board. Democrats in New York are gerrymandering like the House depends on it, said Adam Kincaid, the executive director of the National Republican Redistricting Trust, the party's main map-making organization. Adam Kincaid added, "Republican legislators shouldn't be afraid to legally press their political advantage where they have control." New York's new map doesn't just set Democrats up to win more seats. It also eliminates competitive districts. In 2020, there were 4 districts where Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump were within 5 percentage points of each other. There are none in the new map. Even the reconfigured district that stretches from Republican-dominated Staten Island to Democratic neighborhoods in Brooklyn is now, at least on paper, friendly territory for Democrats. Without that competition from outside the party, many politicians are beginning to see the biggest threat to their careers as coming from within. "When I was a member of Congress, most members woke up concerned about a general election," said former Representative Steve Israel of New York, who led the House Democrats' campaign committee during the last redistricting cycle. He added, "Now they wake up worried about a primary opponent." Mr. Israel, who left Congress in 2017 and now owns a bookstore on Long Island, recalled Republicans telling him they would like to vote for Democratic priorities like gun control, but feared a backlash from their own party's base. "House Democrats," Mr. Israel said, "would like to address issues such as Social Security and Medicare reform, but understand that doing so would draw a robust primary challenge from the party's left wing." Republicans argue that redistricting isn't destiny. The political climate matters, and more races will become competitive if inflation, the lingering pandemic, or other issues continue to sour voters on Democratic leadership. But the far greater number of districts drawn to be overwhelmingly safe for one party is likely to limit how many seats will flip, even in a so-called wave election. The parties are contributing to more and more single-party districts and taking the voters out of the equation, said former Representative Tom Davis, who led the House Republican campaign arm during the 2001 redistricting cycle. Tom Davis added, November becomes a constitutional formality. In the 29 states where maps have been completed and not thrown out by courts, there are just 22 districts that either Joe Biden or Donald Trump won by 5 percentage points or less, according to data from the Brennan Center for Justice, a research institute. By this point in the 2012 redistricting cycle, there were 44 districts defined as competitive based on the previous presidential election results. In the 1992 election, the margin between Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush was within 5 percentage points in 108 congressional districts. The phenomena of the two political parties using redistricting to gain an edge is as old as the Republic itself, but it has escalated in recent decades, with more sophisticated technology and more detailed data about voter behavior. Americans with similar political views have clustered in district areas. Republicans in rural areas and exurban areas, Democrats in cities and inner suburbs. It's a pattern that can make it difficult to draw cohesive, competitive districts. No state has quashed competition ahead of the midterm elections like Texas. In the 2020 election, there were 12 competitive districts in the state of Texas. After redistricting, there is only one. Though Donald Trump won 52% of the vote in Texas in 2020, Republicans are expected to win roughly 65%, 24 of the state's 38 congressional seats. Texas gained 2 seats in the reapportionment after the 2020 census. The Texas state legislatures, who control redistricting, shored up Republican incumbents, including Representatives Dan Crenshaw, Beth Van Duyn, and Michael McCall, but in doing so, also drew safer districts for Democrats, such as Representatives Colin Allred and Lizzie Fletcher. The fact that it's going to be harder for us to pick up congressional seats is a big concern, said Gilberto Hinojosa, chair of the Texas Democratic Party. Hinojosa added, that doesn't mean that we think that it's not important to mount challengers. It's just the reality that it's going to be harder. Democrats did the same where they could. Oregon legislatures took the state's competitive 4th district and turned it into a seat that strongly favors their party. The change was so dramatic that Representative Peter DeFazio, an 18-term Democrat, told reporters last year that he chose to retire because the district is now winnable by another Democrat. Redrawing Mr. DeFazio's district enraged Oregon Republicans. A lack of competition has unintended consequences. Without a competitive race at the congressional level, local parties are deprived of an infusion of money and organizing. Candidates for governor or senate don't benefit from being able to piggyback on the energy and activity at the local level. Anybody running statewide has to pull the wagon entirely themselves because you don't have competitive races going on locally, said Matt Angle, a Democratic activist in Texas. It can sometimes take years to see the full impact of eliminating a competitive district. 10 years ago, North Carolina Republicans took a battleground district in the state's western tip and, by slicing off a piece of the liberal city of Asheville, turned it into a district that John McCain would have carried by 18 percentage points in the 2008 presidential election. the incumbent centrist Democrat, Heath Shuler, retired rather than seek re-election in a district he had little shot at winning. He was replaced by Mark Meadows, who went on to be the founding member of the right-wing House Freedom Caucus before becoming the last White House chief of staff for Donald Trump, and a central figure in Donald Trump's campaign to overturn the 2020 presidential election.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. Another responsibility is to strengthen the Islamic government. An Islamic government with and under the flag of Islam has been established in the Islamic Republic by Allah's favor. Therefore, we must strengthen it, solidify its bases, and expand its products as much as possible. We must have an intelligent and smart plan. This arena is not one where we can simply launch an attack with our heads down, without thinking. It requires planning to carefully study. An intelligent plan must be prepared, and we must deal with this matter in a wise way. This plan must be reliant on a thorough understanding of the characteristics of modern ignorance. If we have misunderstandings about the characteristics of this form of ignorance, we cannot confront and fight against it. We cannot claim that we have attained our goals in these big endeavors. No, we are in the middle of the path in all these lofty causes. There is no doubt about this.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, work has been done, and we have thankfully moved forward
to some extent. But we are in the middle of the way in all these endeavors, and there is a long way for us to reach the goal. But despite the fact that we are in the middle of the way and that we are far away from reaching the goal, the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic model is an attractive model for people all over the world, at least for Muslims. Notice that thousands of kilometers away from Tehran, if someone in another country insults the photograph of our dear martyr Soleimani, the people in that country react in a way that the policeman who has perpetrated the insult is forced to apologize and accompany the people when they are putting up the photograph in the city. This model is an attractive model. This shows that this model has great potential. Even the half-finished form of it has great potential and is attractive. If we can continue the path in a satisfactory and meticulous way, there will be a very attractive and resourceful model, one that will draw nations towards it. This is how it is. We are faced with such form of ignorance.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end the Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians. Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking delegation. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed the implementation of bilateral cooperation agreements. Talks covered cooperation in fighting terrorism, in which Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria for the full liberation of all its territories. The top diplomat briefed President Assad on the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Assad hailed Iran for adhering to principles and rights and the track adopted during the negotiations. He asserted that reaching a deal has become more important in service of Iran and the region's interest as well as international equilibrium.
We had good meetings with President Assad and Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad. We welcome the new approach by some Arab states in restoring relations with Syria. We reaffirmed Iran's readiness to develop relations with Syria and discuss increasing the level of tourist exchange. We hope that in the near future, the presidents of both countries would meet.
A separate meeting was also held between the foreign ministers of Syria and Iran. Focus was laid on the notable increase of trade exchange and means of overcoming the impact of economic sanctions on the two countries.
We discussed means of confronting unilateral illegal sanctions on both states as well as developments currently happening in the meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva. Syria and Iran's stances are identical in this regard. We are in favor of a successful result. However, the other side is not working for national interests.
Syria was the first destination of the regional tour of the Iranian delegation, which also includes Lebanon. Abdullahian's visit is one of many exchanged between both countries' officials. It signals the extensive and continuous cooperation between the two allies at all times, which resulted in a defeat of terror in Syria and currently aims to boost economic partnerships. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Poland's support for fellow Europeans fleeing Ukraine is receiving much praise. However, this has been a huge turnaround, for in past years, the Eastern European country has been heavily criticized for a proud anti-immigration stance, particularly hostile towards Muslim refugees.
Angela Merkel started this madness, and now this is a problem about Muslims mainly coming to Europe.
Amid the anti-Islam rhetoric, Press TV decided to investigate how local Muslims live under these types of challenges.
The Muslim community that lives here in Poland is small but very passionate. It's estimated somewhere between 25 to 40,000 Muslims currently live in the country, making up about 0.1% of the current population, as it's estimated. The majority of them are native Tatars, but also there has been an immigration of Muslims to Poland from various countries. We've come here to one of the main mosques in the capital, Warsaw, to meet the community firsthand.
The imam explained that his main focus has always been to re-educate Poles about Islam and demonstrate Islamic teachings through good deeds.
We teach Quran, we teach Arabic language, and we teach something about Islam. Yes. During Ramadan, because Ramadan is near now, we're making soon 1992, we're making food and iftar for everybody. Every day. From time to time, also, we're making open day. This is for un-Muslims to come to our mosque to hear something and listen about Islam. We made in March open day, and during this activity, 5 women accept Islam.
Despite these successes, Islamophobia still rears its ugly head from time to time. But the mosque uses Islam to combat this also.
One time only, the Polish youth came in front of this masjid and said some bad words about Islam. But I went to them and invited them to here to take a cup of tea, and they became friendly.
In past years, it was Islamic immigration that was considered the major threat in Eastern Europe. Now it's Russia. But conflict in Europe has historically catapulted dangerous ideologies into the forefront. Muslims in Europe look on with caution. Robert Carter, Warsaw.
Yemen's Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a to release its latest statistics of 7 years of Saudi Arabia's war and siege on its neighboring Arab country. The report says more than 46,000 civilians have been killed or injured, including women and the children.
During 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition committed horrific crimes amounting to genocide. There are 46,262 civilians who got killed and wounded as a result of the direct targeting of the Saudi-led coalition's aircraft, including more than 8,000 children and 5,000 women. There is also systematic destruction and targeting of service and economic infrastructure. And the Saudi coalition's air force continues to target roads, bridges, and civilian objects to this day.
The report says more than 500,000 homes were destroyed due to Saudi Arabia's air attacks and thousands of families were displaced. Also, the figures show further destruction of the country's infrastructure.
For 7 years, Saudi Arabia has committed war crimes against Yemeni civilians, but unfortunately, the international community did not fulfill its duty to stop these crimes. Therefore, we see today the Yemeni army intensifying its operations against Saudi territories, and this is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense.
Since the beginning of the war, Saudi Arabia has clearly violated international law multiple times by targeting residential areas across Yemen using cluster munitions. However, this has not pushed the international community to take any measures against Riyadh's war crimes.
After 7 years of killing and destruction in Yemen, observers say Saudi Arabia has not achieved any of its announced goals. On the contrary, Riyadh is facing more retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni forces deep inside its territory. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is the second OIC conference Pakistan hosted in 3 months. In December, foreign ministers from the OIC held an extraordinary session to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. But the latest session was a regular one with an ambitious agenda on the table. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan opened the conference while regretting how the OIC failed both the people of Palestine and Kashmir.
We have failed both the Palestinians and the people of Kashmir. I'm sad to say that we have been able to make no impact at all. They don't take us seriously. We are a divided house, and those powers know it.
For the first time, the Chinese foreign minister attended the OIC conference as a special guest. In his speech, Wang, he said Beijing wants to work closely with the Islamic countries.
China stands ready to work with the Islamic countries to actively advocate true multilateralism, safeguard the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, uphold the UN-centered international system.
The issue of Ukraine also came up for discussions. The OIC Secretary General stressed the need for political solution to the crisis, as he feared the conflict would endanger international peace and stability. The OIC conference coincided with Pakistan Day celebrations. The delegates also attended the National Day Parade.
The two-day conference concluded with OIC members adopting over 100 resolutions. But observers believe that Islamic countries representing 1.5 billion people need to make a difference through actions, as mere statements are not enough. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Cartoons often have the power, by drawing attention quickly and getting straight to the point, to uncover deceit and deliver uncomfortable, shocking messages.
In a span of over 25 years since the early 60s, late Palestinian cartoonist Naji al-Ali produced over 40,000 drawings and several books of cartoons, raising awareness on the Palestinian plight at the hands of Israeli settlers and harshly criticizing Arab regimes and the U.S. imperialistic policies. Today, a book containing tens of cartoons by al-Ali has been published for the first time in Italy.
We have published this book because presently the Palestinian struggle has been put on hold. Nobody talks about it anymore, but the Israeli occupation continues and the elimination of an entire population is ongoing. Ali and his character, Handala, serve as an example of how a cartoon can be more useful than an intifada to stop the occupation and lift the veil of lies covering Palestine.
Naji al-Ali's most famous character is Andala, a 10-year-old barefoot child dressed in ragged clothes. The boy, always drawn from behind while watching all the bad that is happening on Earth, has over time become a symbol of the Palestinian resistance, giving voice to the poor and oppressed. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Andala's creator, Naji al-Ali, as he was murdered outside a newspaper office in the UK in 1987. 5 years ago, London's police department reopened its investigation into the unsolved murder of the Palestinian political cartoonist.
Naji al-Ali's work was for a long time reflective of the Palestinian cause. His cartoons were very critical of everybody involved in the Palestinian plight. Handala means bitter in Arabic and well represents the struggle of the Palestinians. The fact that the boy was drawn from behind meant that everybody, including the Arabic world, had turned their back to Palestine. Al-Ali's assassination was plotted by dark powers, certainly close to the Mossad.
Naji al-Ali's book was recently launched in Naples. It will also be presented in several other Italian cities, including Rome, Genoa, and Bologna. Max Civili, Rome.
On World Water Day, water pollution has reached an alarming level in the besieged Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants. The groundwater in Gaza has high levels of nitrates and other dangerous pollutants, with contamination levels 3 times higher than international standards for safe drinking water. The Israeli regime has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars.
Today, about 98% of our municipal water wells, drinking water wells, their water quality does not fit with the WHO standards related to the drinking water standards.
In recent years, Gaza municipalities were forced to pump untreated raw sewage directly into the sea due to lack of electricity for treatment plants. Raw sewage seepage into the ground has worsened the water crisis. Palestinian officials say Israel has for years deprived residents of Gaza of healthy water supply and stolen their underground resources.
Israel tried to steal our groundwater by having their pumping wells along the eastern border of Gaza Strip and preventing the flow of groundwater by gravity, by lowering the water table and reverse the direction of the groundwater at that location.
The Israeli blockade and wars have taken their toll on Gaza's water infrastructure. Experts say the tiny seaside sliver is currently in a chronic state of water emergency.
Gaza is suffering due to the water catastrophe, with full meaning, shortage of water. At the same time, we have polluted water. We are calling on the international community in order to end this blockade, which is one of the main reasons for such catastrophe that we are living in.
According to human rights organizations, depriving people of water supplies is a clear breach of international law.
On World Water Day, experts say that the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade is the first step towards easing the water crisis in the coastal enclave. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Amid the ongoing fuel crisis in Yemen, the Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to shed further light on the catastrophic consequences of Saudi Arabia's illegal seizure of Yemen's oil ships. The intensification of the siege and the attempt to harm the public service sectors, especially the health sector, which needs electricity permanently, will cause more civilians, including women and children, to be killed. We believe that the United Nations is seeking to prolong the war to benefit from the donor countries' funds, and also because it grants fuel ships transit permits and then provides political cover-up for the piracy acts carried out by the Saudi-led coalition.
Ministry of Human Rights says the fuel crisis has impacted all aspects of life in the war-torn country, including healthcare services, transportation, and public services.
We held this press conference in the presence of many service sector officials to send a message to the world that those who pay lip service to human rights are themselves besieging the Yemeni people. The humanitarian situation today continues to deteriorate, and the Saudi blockade has affected all aspects of life, including the health sector, transportation, and public services. The international community must take serious steps to end the Saudi war in Yemen as they seek to end the Russian-Ukrainian conflict.
Recently, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the blockade it has imposed on Yemen and has prevented the entry of fuel ships to Hodeidah port despite obtaining UN permits. This has led Yemen to the worst fuel crisis since the beginning of the war on March 2015.
People here say the Yemeni army's recent retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia's vital facilities are a normal reaction to Riyadh's illegal measures against Yemen's fuel imports. They believe that the Yemeni army will eventually break the Saudi siege, as Riyadh only understands the language of force. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana.
Since late last week, France has seen nationwide anti-government protests almost every day. March 17th's protests were over better pay and working conditions. March 19th saw the yellow vests and protests against state-sponsored Islamophobia and racism. While March 21st saw the record price of gasoline cause taxi drivers, truckers, fishermen, and others to protest nationwide. President Emmanuel Macron has joined the European Union's unprecedented sanction drive against top energy supplier Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, regardless of the economic costs on the average French household. The price of petrol has crossed the psychological barrier of 2 euros per liter, creating inflation in goods across the board. Those on low and fixed incomes are now being told to make sacrifices by politicians who may be living far more comfortable lifestyles.
I think that people are really suffering. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean much to our leaders. There are elderly people who live off canned sardines, if not canned cat food. French politics is 30 years behind where it should be. And if it doesn't change, there might be a civil war here.
Adding to the hardships being asked of the average French voter, Macron recently announced that if re-elected, he will raise the retirement age to 65. That has caused the left-wing candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, to jump in the first-round polls to third place, but he still trails the far-right's Marine Le Pen by several points.
They aren't even talking about inflation in the election campaign. For everyone in France, it's big news, but not to our candidates. Everyone who isn't rich is wondering if the energy price increases are ever going to stop, while the poor wonder if they are ever going to be targeted by government aid.
While inflation has soared, it's not like this is a new problem for the average French person. Despite long-time official claims of low inflation, reduced purchasing power has been the number one issue for voters in 2017 and 2012 as well. There will be at least two more days of nationwide protests this week. France's first-round presidential vote is now less than 3 weeks away. Many are saying that the final days of Macron's five-year term are ending in a typical fashion, full of anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
عثمان ابن حنیف اعینونی منو یاری کنید با چی؟
این نهج البلاغه letter number 45 امام علی علیه السلام wrote to عثمان ابن حنیف او عثمان support me in piety exertion chastity and uprightness. Now one of the best ways to support our imams is to do our salat on time. This was the main cause for which Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was martyred. Doing morning prayer on time is a practical guideline for those who want to help their imams.
Imam Reza be yeki az baradarash farmud.
Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam once told his brother Zayd, our father Musa ibn Ja'far went to the heaven because of his servitude to Allah. So do not hope to go to paradise by revolt or chaos. Here we are talking about the obligatory actions and not the recommended ones. Of course, recommended deeds are very good. However, if you like to help your imam, first you have to do it through your obligatory actions. These deeds, especially salat on time, brings blessings to your life. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
In the limelight. In the past month, the BA2 variant has gone from 3% of cases sequenced to more than 20%, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist. This article is published under the heading Unease About Possible New COVID Surge Grows with Rise of BA2 Variant. Here's more. NBC's local New York City Channel 4 recently said rising COVID infections associated with the so-called stealth Omicron variant BA2 are fueling fresh leeriness about the state of the pandemic in New York City and America, just as life as we now know it is starting to return to normal. According to the CDC, that variant accounts for 39% of COVID circulating in New York and New Jersey right now. By comparison, it's responsible for about a quarter of new infections nationally. Its prevalence has doubled in just the last week or so. USA Today also recently said a new COVID variant is spreading across Pennsylvania. Data released last week shows. In the past month, the BA2 variant has gone from 3% of cases sequenced to more than 20%, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Both articles are at pains to explain that Americans don't yet know enough about the BA2 to adequately assess its menace at this time, but they go on to suggest it's probably nothing to worry about right now. As with Delta and Omicron, no new precautions are being instituted. Indeed, mask mandates and other protections are disappearing all across the U.S., yet even after the twin debacle brought by those variants, the news seems resolutely determined to hold to a positive outlook as they watch the approach of this newest one, the first true test of the living with the virus method that capitalism has craved for 2 years now. No lesser light than COVID expert Anthony Fauci popped up recently to join in assurances, according to The Times, saying Dr. Anthony Fauci, the Biden administration's top advisor on the pandemic, predicted an uptick in coronavirus infections similar to the current increase in Europe, despite the current decline in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths in the United States, while anticipating a new rise. Dr. Fauci said that at this time, he does not expect a surge. Still, the BA2 subvariant has been shown to be a more contagious version of the Omicron variant, though it, too, causes less severe illness in most people. Epidemiologists have said the current lull in U.S. cases mirrors the dip that Europe enjoyed before many officials in the region relaxed restrictions like indoor masking. If Fauci proclaimed water to be wet, a segment of the population would drown in the local bog trying to prove him wrong. This is a fact of modern politics. The vast temptations of conspirational fictions over the long grind of scientific truth. Fauci has offered a level voice and a steady hand, for the most part, which is nothing short of remarkable, given how often Donald Trump lit Fauci's podium on fire with his cascading failure of an approach to the pandemic. Not everyone who believes in Fauci is fully accepting his prediction that the variant will merely cause an uptick instead of a surge, however. Benjamin Mueller of the New York Times reports that scientists and health officials are bracing for another swell in the pandemic and with it, the first major test of the country's strategy of living with the virus while limiting its impact, adding, the clearest warnings that the brief period of quiet may soon be over have come, as they often have in the past 2 years from Western Europe. In a number of countries, including Britain, France, and Germany, case numbers are climbing as an even more contagious subvariant of Omicron, known as BA2, takes hold. In interviews, 10 epidemiologists and infectious disease experts said that many of the ingredients were in place for the same to happen in the United States, though it was unclear if or when a wave might hit or how severe it might be. If or when BA2 or another variant like it attacks with full force and causes yet another devastating round of deaths and economic hardships, the current live-with-it posture in the United States has left Americans thoroughly unprepared again. This is particularly true after Congress cut $1.6 billion in COVID funding to catastrophic effect. Next week, the government will have to cut shipments of monoclonal antibody treatments by a third. In April, it will no longer be able to reimburse healthcare providers for testing, vaccinating, or treating millions of uninsured Americans who are disproportionately likely to be unvaccinated and infected. Come June, it won't be able to support domestic testing manufacturers. If such variants arise, they will likely catch the U.S. off guard because surveillance networks will have to be scaled back too. Should people need further booster shots, the government won't have enough for anyone. Republicans believe they have gained the upper hand in their rhetorical fight surrounding COVID, particularly in regard to money allocated to fight the disease. To their minds, the country's "so over it, you guys" mood is worth hanging their overall COVID strategy on. We shall see one way or the other, and that soon. I think we've learned at this point to not underestimate what kind of sort of evolutionary leaps this virus can make, University of Utah virologist Stephen Goldstein told Gride, adding, we should be pretty humble about making predictions about that's next. That cuts both ways, doesn't it? Like a hot knife, keep your eyes open and don't toss those masks just yet.